Welcome to the Gestalt IT Rundown, where each time we meet, we run down the IT news of the week with a variable degree of snarkiness. I'm your host, Stephen Foskett, and joining me today is Tom Hollingsworth. No, that's not Tom. Who is that? Hey, it's W. Curtis Preston. Welcome to the show, Mr. Curtis.
Very much not Tom, but glad to be here.
It's nice to have you here, my friend. You and I have been friends for a long, long time. I've always wanted to get you on the show, and I'm thrilled to have you joining us here on National Brothers Day. You're like a brother to me.
Yeah, you know, it's also National Scavenger Hunt Day. I love a good scavenger hunt. I don't know about you.
Sure.
What about Yucatan Shrimp Day? What do you think?
Yucatan shrimp sounds kind of yucky to me, but I don't know. Maybe they're delicious. So I'm going to take my brother on a scavenger hunt for Yucatan shrimp. But in the meantime, let's turn to some of the news of the week.
So the recent ruling by the Cyberspace Administration of China to prevent Micron technology products from being used in critical information systems marks a significant development in the ongoing trade war between China and the United States. This move, stemming from allegations of cybersecurity crimes, not only impacts Micron, but also highlights the broader complexities surrounding global semiconductor supply chains and the pursuit of self-sufficiency in key technologies. What are the implications of Micron's exclusion from Chinese markets, and what does this mean for the ongoing financial struggle between China and the West? What do you think, Stephen?
Yeah, it's an interesting story. When I first heard wind of this, I was really scratching my head because I'm saying, you know, what is Micron? Again, so Micron is one of the leading producers of DRAM and flash memory in competition with two Korean companies, SK Hynix and Samsung. What does Micron have to do with cybersecurity, and what kind of possible cybersecurity threat could there be from Micron DRAM and flash memory products? I mean, we're not even talking necessarily assembled components here. We're talking literally memory chips. And then it occurred to me that this has nothing to do with Micron's products whatsoever. In fact, as my good friend Jim Handy points out, this is really more about the trade war between China and the U.S. than it is about anything. And previously, China did block Micron products very verbally, vocally, and then didn't really block them at all once it became obvious what that would do to production. Now, I don't know what this is going to mean for Micron overall, but I will say that maybe this is more bluster than it is reality. So a couple of things to note. Number one, this only blocks the use of Micron products in what the CAC is calling, critical sensitive systems. This doesn't block China from importing or using Micron memory or SSDs in products for export, or even just general products. At least that's my read on this for use in China. It really is focused on blocking, basically striking a blow against a U.S. company that's supplying a critical component to Chinese intelligence and systems. Frankly, it strikes me that Micron was picked mainly because the other choice would have been Intel, and maybe China didn't want to block Intel products, even though many of those are restricted now from the China market. I should also mention, as I said, this is not the first time that Micron has been blocked, and the other time didn't have much impact. Overall, Micron themselves say that the most impact this would have would be about a 25% hit on the company's product consumption, and probably a lot less than that. And also, I should mention that those other companies that I mentioned, Samsung and SK Hynix, well, they don't seem all that optimistic and positive about one of their key competitors being blocked in this market. And that's because the memory RAM and flash market, although it is competitive, I think that there's an understanding that there needs to be competition. There needs to be multiple suppliers in this market, and no one wants to see their market hit by basically a political game. So frankly, I really don't see this being more than another round of bluster in the international relations game, and not too much impact on Micron. Curtis, Cohesity recently announced a significant expansion of its partnership with Google Cloud. The collaboration aims to leverage large language models and advanced AI technologies to enhance data insights and strengthen data security. The joint effort was unveiled during Cohesity's Catalyst virtual conference, where the companies highlighted their focus on generative AI, data analytics, and the expansion of the Data Security Alliance. We've been hearing an awful lot about large language models and cybersecurity, but you know this market better than me. What does this mean? Is this really an impact, or is it just more AI noise?
Well, I, you know, when I saw the story, I was like, oh, more AI news. That was my first reaction. But I think this is, at least it's the first one where it is encroaching on my part of the world. There has been a lot of ML, use of ML in backup and recovery technology for a while. But to cross over into the AI world, I think is a big deal. The big difference, of course, is whether or not you're using data to train the model, right? Where machine learning is just looking for patterns, AI is going beyond that. They're talking about it. I think the first thing that they mention is the ransomware anomaly detection, which of course, which is what everybody is concerned about. I do say, you know, as I said, even when I worked for another company, that if your backup system is the place where you found out you had ransomware, you have bigger problems. But it is important. I think it's extremely important to have ransomware detection in a backup system. And of course, Cohesity is used for much more than backup as well. They're also looking for threat intelligence, you know, hunting down and detecting other threats. And then also for some other concepts like data classification and predictive capacity planning, that all sounds very important. This retrieval augmented generation model, there's some concepts in there that they talked about, which I would, I will take a wait and see approach. It sounds very interesting. This idea is that it could assist in retrievals. It could assist in restores. I think it's one of those where I'll have to wait and see exactly what that means. It sounds very interesting. I think they get credit for being the first vendor in my space to actually say they're using actually AI versus ML. I know some vendors have used the term AI, but generally what they were talking about was ML. So let's take a look at the next thing here. Alibaba, the Chinese e-commerce giant, has announced plans to spin off its intelligence group, which includes its cloud, AI, and business messenger units, as an independent publicly listed company. Alibaba will unlock value from its businesses and attract external investors. But it's surprising that Alibaba Cloud, which dominates the Chinese market, would be spun out. What do you think is happening here, Stephen?
Yeah, this one, at the face of it, could look like, I don't know, maybe a new competitor for Google and Amazon, maybe a big deal for China. But reading a little bit further, what I found was this probably says a lot more about Alibaba and their success or lack of success recently in the Chinese consumer market than anything. So you may know of Alibaba as sort of the website where you can get anything delivered from China. But of course, it's also basically the Amazon of China, including AWS. So Alibaba's cloud is an incredibly powerful, versatile cloud computing environment and is used by all sorts of applications in that market. Well, the spinoff would seem strange because why would the company be doing, you know, separating out such a valuable component? I mean, could you imagine Amazon separating out AWS? Well, actually, yeah, and probably for the same reason. essentially what they're doing here is they're doing a financial maneuver. They're going to spin it out as a separate company. They're going to retain partial ownership, and it allows them basically to make some more money off the most valuable part of the business, which is the cloud, and insulate it from the impacts of slowing consumer spending, shifts in consumer demand, shifts in cloud usage in the Chinese market. And so, frankly, I wouldn't read too much into this, except that it means that the economic slowdown that we've been seeing here in the U.S. is also hitting China, and importantly, hitting Chinese cloud companies. Microsoft Build 2023 was all about AI integration. Windows 11 will feature an AI Copilot for text-related tasks, while Microsoft 365 Copilot now supports plugins, including Teams, Messages, extensions, and Power Platform connectors. Additionally, the Edge browser will integrate a 365 Copilot, and even Windows Terminal is going to incorporate an AI-powered chatbot. And of course, there's Bing, which becomes the default search engine for ChatGPT with expanded plugin support. Microsoft is certainly leaning into AI and calling everything Copilot. What's going on here?
So that's an interesting concept, that Bing would be the default search engine for ChatGPT. Trying to figure out how that exact that one phrase stuck out to me, because it was just, I think it was just yesterday that Bill Gates was on somewhere basically saying that AI will essentially replace search engines in the relatively near future. So that interesting phrase stuck out. I think that, I mean, they're certainly leaning into it. The question is whether or not how big of a deal this is. And the question is, if you're using AI, like this interactive AI, you have to basically make an effort to do so, meaning that even if they make the functionality, for example, of ChatGPT or something like that available to the average user, unless they're specifically start talking to it the way you talk to something like ChatGPT, the benefits will be minimal. So how big of a deal this is will be based on how well the users actually embrace it. And I don't know. I'm just not sure the average user is ready to interact with an AI chatbot. I've interacted quite a bit with ChatGPT. I find it very interesting. I find some of the stuff that it has done for me to be very interesting. I'm just not sure if the average user is ready to do that, but we shall see what we shall see. So let's talk about Blue Cat Networks acquiring Men and Mice, a recent Tech Field Day presenter with an industry-leading DDI platform. The acquisition strengthens Blue Cat's position in the market and allows them to offer advanced network tools to organizations of all sizes. This move comes in response to the increasing demand for DDI management and fits well with Blue Cat's portfolio for mid-market and enterprise organization. What's your take, Stephen?
Yeah, I was not really surprised that this happened. I couldn't have predicted exactly when it would happen and maybe even exactly who the acquiring company would be. But Men and Mice has built a really nice product. As we saw actually on my birthday at Tech Field Day, the product is great and it addresses a big hole in the market. We actually even did a Field Day roundtable discussion talking about the challenges of DDI, basically managing IP addresses, managing DHCP, managing DNS. If just hearing those phrases makes you sort of shudder, then you must be an IT person because they're terrible. And Blue Cat has been working in this space for a long time, or at least adjacent spaces. Men and Mice was basically founded to attack this problem. And they've created a solution that was pretty appealing, I have to say. The Tech Field Day delegates were pretty impressed by it. And frankly, it's no wonder that one of the major companies in this space said, we need to have that as part of our portfolio. The whole thing makes a lot of sense. I would say that, you know, overall, having it be Blue Cat is probably better than having it be, I don't know, some big multi-product company that this would sort of get lost in. I think this will be a big, an important feature, an important highlight for Blue Cat. I think Blue Cat's customers are going to benefit. And I think the exposure to greater customer environments from Men and Mice products, I think that's going to help them as well. So overall, I'd say this is a pretty nice acquisition. I'm pretty happy with it. And also, I will say that if you're wondering exactly what I'm talking about, just use your favorite search engine, search for Men and Mice in Tech Field Day, and you'll see their recent presentation, which goes over all about the product and its features and what it's all about. The recent rulings by the U.S. Supreme Court in cases involving Google and Twitter have reaffirmed the legal protections for major tech platforms. The courts found that these platforms cannot be held liable for content posted by users, specifically in relation to terrorism-related content. But I think that this goes a little bit broader than that. The decisions emphasize the importance of Section 230, a telecommunications law that shields tech companies from liability and that has become a bit of a political football lately. The discussion explores the implications of these rulings and the ongoing debate about Section 230. What does this mean for the future of social media platforms?
Well, I think that this is definitely the most political of any of the things that we're discussing today. I think this is pretty straightforward. Basically, they rule that it didn't violate, that 230 protects them. And we can argue all day long that, you know, there were a lot of people that were upset about there not being any accountability for things that some of these tech platforms have allowed to happen. And there's been a lot of noise about going after the tech platforms for things that they have allowed to happen. The problem is that the problem for those people that are saying that is that 230 backs these platforms. That basically the idea was that since they're just aggregating other people's content, they're not liable for that content. The people that did it are liable. I think that this allows those companies to breathe a little bit for the moment, but I also think that that they should look forward to. And when I say normally when we say look forward, we mean it in a positive way. They should look forward to something that isn't Section 230. I think that at some point, whether or not it comes out of this current Congress or any of our Congresses is a different discussion point. But basically what this ruling said was you can't count on Section 230 if you want to go after these companies. Or I could put that in a different order. You can't go after these companies as long as 230 is the rule of the land. So if you want to do that, you need to change the laws. So I think it's a huge ruling. And I think that the social media platforms can probably breathe a sigh of relief for the moment. So let's talk about PlyOps introducing an efficient Redis cluster powered by XDP Rocks, delivering in-memory performance and SSD-like cost economics. The collaboration optimizes Redis on flash performance using hardware acceleration, allowing economic scaling of application data footprints. PlyOps is also expanding its partnership with Phoenix NAP, offering PlyOps-powered bare metal cloud instances for Redis on flash clusters, enabling faster data processing, sub-millisecond latency, and significant cost savings. When you saw PlyOps at Cloud Field Day a few years ago, would you have predicted this, Stephen?
Yeah, I'm actually really excited to see PlyOps doing this. They presented a couple of times at Tech Field Day, and I have to say that it always seemed like the product was undersold as basically a RAID card or a storage controller. What PlyOps is doing with their card isn't what, you know, an old RAID card does. It really is fundamentally taking the data and making a new storage platform for it. Now, wisely, the company decided that we're going to offer basically storage on the thing because that's what applications want. But really what's going on under the hood is a key value store and something that essentially is a hardware accelerated database that's optimized for Flash. Now, yeah, you can put just regular data on that, but that's sort of a waste of the platform. I was really excited to hear about this because, frankly, it seems to me that Redis is an ideal front-end candidate for the PlyOps XDP platform. And this really showcases what this product is capable of. I would love to see more and more of this. I'd love to see PlyOps sort of not be thought of as, yeah, we're doing RAID, we're doing data protection, we're doing storage, but as, yeah, we're offering in-memory performance of databases using Flash as the back end, which of course is a lot cheaper, a lot more accessible to more people in the market. So overall, good move, PlyOps. I'm glad to see this happening. I'm also glad to see that they've managed to roll this out with a cloud partner. Now, you know, maybe, you know, you don't know too much about PhoenixNAP. I certainly don't, but it's nice to see that people could explore this product, try it out, and see if it really delivers the goods without having to go out and build a whole infrastructure of their own. So overall, nice move, PlyOps, and I'm glad to hear that things are moving in the right direction. Curtis, we've got you on the rundown this week. Everybody knows you as Mr. Backup, Mr. Data Protection, Mr. Ransomware, frankly. That's why I wanted to take a closer look at some ransomware stories this week, because frankly, I think your expertise in this matter is, certainly beyond mine and beyond a lot of people. So these ransomware attacks are continuing to pose a significant threat across many sectors of the environment, with recent incidents targeting critical industries and causing substantial financial and operational damages. Federal authorities have issued warnings about a surge in cyber attacks that exploit a high severity vulnerability in Veeam software that enables unauthorized access and raises the risk of data theft and ransomware deployment. Healthcare organizations are heavily reliant on Veeam for data protection, and so there's a huge implication for these attacks that's particularly concerning to me. But the impact of ransomware is way beyond this, as demonstrated by other incidents that we've found recently, including companies like Dole, which had a $10.5 million direct cost impact from a ransomware attack, and the ongoing attack on the Dallas Municipal Court building, of all things, disrupting legal proceedings and potentially exposing sensitive personal and case-related information. Since you're an expert and you know about this stuff, please help us understand what is going on with ransomware.
Well, you know, this is one of those where I feel like Henny Penny is saying the sky is falling, but it is getting really bad. These are some great stories. I think the Veeam one frustrates me the most, and not this isn't even about Veeam. Veeam announced a fix to that vulnerability days after it was announced. That was in March. So it bothers me. We're now, 2 months later, and we're still talking about this vulnerability as being, the announcement was from the Fed saying, hey, this is still being used to exploit people, to which I want to say, how, right? How is it that anyone who cares anything about their data hasn't addressed this vulnerability in their Veeam backup servers? I don't understand that at all, right? So the other thing is, regarding Dole, the Dole story was very interesting in that Dole was basically said that their data protection system worked as designed. It only cost them $6 million to do the restore, to which I want to say, right. And it was like another $5 million in other costs having to do with continuing operations, because they were down for quite a while. And then Dallas, the Dallas story, they're still down, right? This whole week so far, if you need to do, if you want to have a case in the Dallas court, you're not doing it this week because it's still down. we don't know how long it will be down. And there's actually another story that wasn't on this list, and that was Chile. So there's a story that happened a year ago where think what happened to Dallas, but happening to an entire country. So the Conti ransomware group took out almost all of Chile's what we would call federal infrastructure, right? So think of all of the things like the FBI, the CIA, the Supreme Court, the Justice Department. Think about all of those departments that we have. They have similar departments to those, and they all got taken offline with a ransomware attack that also attacked their backup system. And they never recovered. So they're still, as of now, this is a year later, they're still basically rebuilding their federal infrastructure from scratch. That's the thing I think that people need to think about, is that it's not, I think for a while there, what I was saying was, folks, you need to address the vulnerabilities in your backup system. Things like making sure that you are applying the patch that Veeam supplied, making sure that you do all of the things that you need to do to secure your backup system so that it's not subject to an attack that will also take out your infrastructure. Because if that happens, I thought that the worst that would happen would be that you would have to pay the ransom. But the worst is actually worse, in that you might just not exist as a company if the ransomware group feels like it. In this case, Conti, the story actually with Chile, Conti actually apparently used this happening as purely subterfuge, because what they did was, at this moment, they diffused Conti into the woodwork and just passed out all its people to other companies. And so think of that, a ransomware group that is so evil that they attack you and encrypt all your infrastructure and encrypt your backup systems just out of spite, or maybe by a competitor that wants to take you out. So if you're not absolutely terrified about ransomware, I don't know what to tell you. Your company could just basically cease to exist tomorrow. And so you need to be looking at securing your backup infrastructure. To me, it's the first thing. I know, Mr. Backup, of course I say that, but here's the thing. It's helms deep, right? It's the last line of defense, and you need to secure it now. You do need to have something on the front end that is trying to stop ransomware and trying to detect it when it happens so that you can minimize the impact of that. Yes, you need to do all of that, but you need to make sure now that you've done the things that you need to secure your infrastructure. I think that it should not, for example, share with your Active Directory. I don't think there should be basically, if they hack Active Directory, they should not be able to then directly access your backup system. The stuff on which you're storing your backups should be as immutable as possible. If you're using an on-prem backup system, the best thing today is to make sure that at least one copy is up in the cloud somewhere, stored, in write protected immutable storage. There are some immutable storage on-prem, but even those have some limitations. But, ask your, so I'll just say this, go to your backup vendor now and ask them what you should do to make your backups from them more secure. I am absolutely sure they will have an answer to that question. So to go back, so the fact that there are apparently still plenty of Veeam customers that haven't gone back to Veeam and said, hey, is there a patch I need to apply? It's very disheartening. So that's my thoughts.
But of course, those of us who've been in IT for a long time understand that the breadth of unpatched, out-of-date systems is large, and the number of systems that are exposed either through misconfiguration or maybe even in some cases intentional misconfiguration just to make life easier on a day-to-day basis is large. I think it's just remarkable to consider, you know, one of the things when it comes to ransomware, I just consider, imagine if this was a physical attack instead of a cyber attack. Imagine if the government of Chile was physically invaded by a gang of criminals who blocked and destroyed all government services. And, you know, would the response be, oh, well, we'll better buy some new buildings and set up some new government services over there? You know, imagine if Dole Corporation had a group of criminals burst into the lobby and burn the building down. Would their response be, oh, well, we better build a new one? There would be a different response. And I think the fact that this is cyber, you know, virtual soft, I think it really, really changes the way that people approach these things, and not in a positive way. I mean, again, think about it. If the Dallas Municipal Court was shut down by people with guns or bombs or something, there would be not just a federal, there would be an international response. There, you know, it wouldn't be down for 2, 3, 4 weeks. It would be a massive government response. And I expect, honestly, my expectation is that eventually the people in governments around the world are going to say, you know what, we need to treat these things like real physical attacks. And that is not necessarily going to be a great day, because to be honest with you, having the government and the military and the intelligence agencies and everything suddenly getting involved in these things, it just escalates the whole situation. I don't know what to say about it, except that our audience of IT practitioners, IT pros, should listen to Curtis on this one. Update your systems, apply the patches, ask your providers what you can do to mitigate this stuff, because it's going to happen. And you can't rely on the NSA or the Army to protect you from ransomware. It's gonna happen, and you got to protect yourself from it. The other thing that occurs to me about this stuff is that it's important to realize that, as you're pointing out with Chile, the ransomware gangs aren't always after the ransom. And in some cases, they may not even have the ability to decrypt the data. I've heard that as well. I mean, there's wiper ransomware, you know, that is actually not encryption at all. And of course, there's now disclosures that are happening as a result. And of course, data protection doesn't protect you from that. I wonder what you think about that angle, Curtis. So, for example, like in the Dallas case, if these guys exfiltrated all sorts of sensitive case files and things like that, they could theoretically be in a much different ransom position than just basically saying, the stuff's deleted. Good luck restoring that.
Yeah, this so-called double extortion has now become the most common method, right? So they exfiltrate some data, and then they say, well, we have this data and we will release it if you don't pay the ransom. And, you know, I'll just say, if it's not obvious, I'm not a fan of paying the ransom, right? So because of, you know, paying the ransom just encourages more ransoms. And it also encourages even you specifically, that it will make other ransomware groups. So, oh, here's a group that paid the ransom. Maybe they'll pay one from us. So not a fan. The difficulty is with the extortion or the extortionware, where they say we have information. So in the case of the Dallas situation, they're saying they have some data that they're going to publish. What Dallas is saying that they don't, that there's no evidence that they actually have it, that they're just saying that. There are ways for what the groups will do is they say they'll publish it privately. They'll say, this is what we have, buddy. Go look. And then you look and you see and you're like, okay. Well, we need to do something. It is much harder to deal with than simply having a good backup system. The only way to fix that one is to have a time machine, right? Is to go back to when, you know, the attack happened in the first place. And so that's why, we talked earlier about DDI. DDI is one of the ways that you can, a good DDI system can actually help on the front end of looking for and hunting down and stopping data exfiltration. And so I think that that's what companies and organizations need to do, is to add this to the things that they need to look for. But, I know that so many companies already aren't doing the basics. You know, there was an attack yesterday that I forget who it was, but in the story it said that if they had enabled MFA, it would have stopped the attack. And I just want to say, I get very frustrated. You know, we're talking about complicated things that we want people to go out and do, use DDI and other systems to look for data exfiltration, and they're not even turning on MFA. I don't know. Do the simple things first, right? Do those simple things. Have a good password management system. Have MFA. These things that and make sure that you're using a different password everywhere, all of those things, do the basic things. Oh, and patch management, right? Those are the top three. You do those three and you're going to stop about 80-90% of the attacks. And then if you're serious, do these other things.
Yeah. Do the simple things, control what you can control, and try to prepare for the inevitable, which is that eventually these things are going to start, are going to appear in your environment as well. Thanks so much for joining us for the rundown this week, Curtis. It's been great to have you on here. Before we go, where can people find more of your work and continue this conversation with you?
Well, if they want to hear me talk more, that would be go to the Backup Central Restore It All podcast. We do a weekly podcast over there where me and Persona talk about things such as these. We talk about ransomware quite a bit. You may hear the word 3-2-1 rule. Excuse me. You may hear the word 3-2-1 rule come up once or twice. And also, if you want to follow me on Twitter, it's at WC Preston. If you want to contact me, wcurtispreston@gmail.com.
Thanks so much, Curtis.
Anytime.
Let's take a look at some of the events that are going on this week and the week ahead. Next week, I will be in Boston for Cloud Field Day. I'm pretty excited about that one. Wednesday and Thursday, you'll hear from Couchbase, Haiku, Jetstream Software, Morpheus Data, Rackend, and Zerto. So please do tune in on LinkedIn or the Tech Field Day website for those, or check out the recordings on YouTube after the event. We're also headed to Cisco Live, June 6th and 7th. We've got Cisco presenting, of course. We've got a lot of Cisco content coming there, as well as our friends from Backbox and OpenGear. And of course, we've got a security field day event and an edge field day event coming up as well. So stay tuned and we'll tell you more about those. Also, I would mention that this is a pretty busy week in the event schedule. Of course, you may have heard of Dell Tech World happening right now, the Red Hat Summit, also ISC High Performance, VeeamON, GlueCon, all of those things are happening this week. So check out your favorite sources for live updates from that. And we'll bring the highlights from those events to the rundown next week. Thanks for watching the Gestalt IT Rundown. You can catch new episodes every Wednesday as a YouTube video or in your favorite podcast application. We'll be back next Wednesday to talk about all of the IT news from those events and more. But until then, for myself, for Curtis, for Tom Hollingsworth, and all of us here at the Gestalt IT family, have a great week, and we'll see you next Wednesday.